I'm Richard Piacentini, the executive director at FIPS. I'm also on the board of the International Living Future Institute, and I want to talk about one of the programs that they have called the Red List. And this, so my presentation is about toxic chemicals in the built environment. And I want to tell you about our experience with toxic chemicals in the built environment. And it goes back to this the building that's right outside the door here, the Center for Sustainable Landscapes, which opened in December of 2012. And when we started that building, we wanted to go for the Living Building Challenge, which had just come out. And the Living Building Challenge is the most rigorous green building standard in the world to date. And when we started this process, we thought that some of the requirements that they were going to make us do to get certified were going to be the hardest ones. We thought were going to be things like being net zero energy. The building has to make all its own energy from renewable energy on site with no combustion. We thought the other one that was going to be very hard was this idea of being net zero water, that the building has to capture and treat all the storm water on site, and all the sanitary water that's produced on site has to be treated on site. Well, it turned out that the hardest part was not energy or water. The hardest part was the materials pedal and the requirements of not using toxic chemicals in buildings. And they have this thing called the Red List, which lists 22 different classes of chemical compounds that you're forbidden to have anywhere in the project. And as we started to get into this project, we started to look at this list, we started to think about, why? I mean, I knew all about lead paint, and I knew about some of these other things like, you know, mercury and chromium and things like that, but some of these other things I wasn't really that familiar with. And I really started trying to figure out, you know, how is this going to impact the project? And very, very interesting thing happened. Right about the time that we were getting ready to start design on the project, I met a visiting professor from Germany, and I was telling him about our project, and I was telling him about this thing called the Red List. And I was telling him all about this, and all of a sudden he smiled and he looked at me and he goes, "Oh, you Americans really make me laugh." And he says, "What's the first thing you do when you know you're going to have a baby? You paint the room, you buy new furniture, you buy a new rug, and when the baby arrives, you put him in the room, you lock the door, and you put a baby monitor on him so you can watch him from a safe distance. Meanwhile, they're breathing in all these toxic fumes that are coming off all this new paint, furniture, and rug." And it really, that was a real game changer for me. That one really woke me up, and I said, you know, how many people know somebody that's done that, or know somebody who knows somebody that's done that? I mean, we just don't think about these things. We just assume that everything that you can buy is safe and there's no problem with anything. We just don't think about it. It comes down to awareness, and it really comes down to being understanding, you know, what's going on, how we are exposed to some chemicals, and what the impacts are, and what we need to do about it. This was another one that I remember going back when I was a kid on Long Island. We used to go sailing over along the Great South Bay. And every once in a while, we were sitting along on the docks. These trucks would come by, and they would just blow all this fog to kill the mosquitoes. And we were told, oh, that's safe. And then this fog would waft over us. It turns out that fog was DDT, and it wasn't safe. But it took people becoming aware and people getting outraged, primarily through the work of Rachel Carson, who's from Pittsburgh, by the way, and who started that whole environmental movement to get people to make changes to stop this from happening. And what we realize is that we really have no effective chemical regulation in the U.S. right now. And Pete mentioned this last night, that, you know, there's 83,000 chemicals in EPA's inventory. 62,000 of those chemicals were grandfathered in when the toxic law Substance Act came in 1976, and only 200 of them, I think, have actually been tested right now. Some of them have been, there's some regulations now, things like asbestos, PCBs, dioxins, CFCs, and hexavalent chromium, but still there's a lot of toxic chemicals out there that we just know nothing about. And there really is no toxicity data on 4 out of 5 of the most commonly used chemicals. And the other thing we don't, you know, when we talk about some of these problems, the other thing we fail to recognize that a lot of times these chemicals are more toxic when they're combined with other chemicals. And so there's a synergistic effect as well. So we started to work on our project. And one of the requirements of the Living Building Challenge is you have to document that there's not none of these chemicals are in any of the products that are used in your building. So which means you have to go to the manufacturer and you have to get a letter from them stating, you know, are any of these chemicals, you show them the list of chemicals and you say, are any of these chemicals in your building, in your product? And what we found out was two things. One is either they didn't know what was in their product or they didn't want to tell us. And it was extremely hard. And this turned out to be the hardest thing that we did, because those 22 classes of compounds really, when you look at them, we're really talking about 800 different chemicals that are found in building products right now. And I have to tell you, this was back in 2007 when we started the project, and we found that nobody wanted to talk to us about this. We're now working on our fourth living building project, and I can tell you that it's gotten a lot easier. And I think manufacturers are starting to recognize that people are asking questions. They want to know what's in their products. They're actually starting to reformulate some of their products based on the living building challenge to get some of these toxic chemicals out. So there are some things that are happening in a positive direction. Another example, when we were building our project, our building, there was only one rug in the United States that was Red List free. One. Out of all the companies that make carpets in the United States, only one of them was Red List free. Now, fortunately, it came in a few colors, so we were able to at least pick at least we had some choice. And I can tell you now that there's substantially more companies. There's a number of companies making lots of different products that are Red List free, which is a really good thing to see. The other thing that we found when we were doing this building was we wanted to have nice new wooden doors in this building. We could not find a single wooden door made in the United States that didn't have formaldehyde in it. So there's no new wooden doors in that building. The Living Building Challenge, through their Red List program, also really tries to understand exposure routes. You know, how are we coming in contact with these things, whether it be we're inhaling it, it's coming in through our skin, we're ingesting it. Particularly, you know, obviously the most vulnerable members in society are children. But it's not just the people that are using the product that we're concerned about. The Living Building Challenge Red List also looks at the whole route of exposure throughout the lifetime of that material. So we're concerned about, what about the raw material extraction? Is it toxic to the people that are extracting that material? What about the people who are manufacturing those products? Is it toxic to them? Or the fence line communities that live around those companies, how is that impacting them? These are often, you know, people with low income that can't afford to live anywhere else. They're exposed to some of these chemicals as well. There's also concerns about the people who are making constructing the building, when they're sawing the materials or applying the materials, as well as the building occupants. And then at the end of life of that product, you know, what happens to it when it gets disposed of, and how does it affect people and the environment as well? So these are all things that are taken into account when we're creating the Red List for this program. Just want to go through a couple of some of the key ones that are of concern. Formaldehyde, it's pervasive in just about everything. One of the things about formaldehyde is that it is it's very cheap, and it's a good binder. So you see it in things like pressed woods, insulation, paints, textiles, countertops, resins, coatings. Really, really hard to find products without formaldehyde, but a very, very toxic chemical. Some of the health effects of formaldehyde are asthma and cancer. It's a respiratory irritant, and it can also cause nervous system damage. Another chemical that's forbidden in building products in the Living Building Challenge through the Red List is mercury, which is found in wiring and switches. Compact fluorescent light bulbs have mercury. Those are now banned from being in Living Building Challenge products. That's one of the new requirements of some of the later editions of that program. It's also found in batteries and paint. And again, mercury is a very important nervous system toxin, as well as causing things like kidney damage and memory loss and things like that. PVC is ubiquitous in building products. It's on wiring, it's in pipes, it's on countertops, it's, you know, everywhere you look, there's PVC. This is one of the hardest ones to get out of any kind of project. And 75% of all the PVC that's made in this country is used in construction materials. And the problem with PVC is not so much for the user, the end product. The real problem with PVC is when it's manufactured or disposed, it causes the release of dioxin, which is one of the most toxic chemicals known. And dioxin causes things like cancer, endocrine disruption, endometriosis, neurological damage, birth defects, and reproductive and immune system damage. This again, it was one of the hardest ones to get out of the building when we built the building. Flame retardants, we already heard some talk about flame retardants, how toxic they are. The sad thing about flame retardants is that they really don't work. But they're found in lots and lots of materials. And fortunately, we are starting to be able to find products that don't have flame retardants in them, but the effects on existing products that we have in existing buildings is pretty serious. Another major product problem is with volatile organic compounds, which are found in paint, furniture, carpet, adhesives, and sealants. These are the things that are called the sick building syndrome. These are very hard to get out of products as well. But again, a lot of negative health impacts is from them as well. We've already heard a lot about BPA. BPA is found in clear plastic containers. It's found in grout and sealants, and it's applied in the fluid-applied flooring. And again, we talked about some of this, and we'll hear more about this later today, about some of the negative health effects, like things like prostate cancer, breast cancer, and reproductive failure. BPA, as we heard from Matt's talk, it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Cash register receipts, through canned goods. Everywhere you look, there's BPA, which is a serious problem. So those are just some of the chemicals of the 22 classes of chemicals that are forbidden to be in the Living Building Challenge building projects. The Living Building Challenge also tries to focus on the precautionary principle, and we heard talk about this last night, that it's really important that we figure out, we moved in a direction where chemicals don't come onto the market until they're proven safe, as opposed to the way that it is now, chemicals can come onto the market, and you have to prove that they're harmful before you can take them off the market. Well, we know that doesn't work, and here are some examples here. When we knew that risks were identified for things like lead paint back in 1949, but regulations didn't happen until the 1970s. Things like asbestos, we knew it was a problem in 1970, nothing happened until 1989. So these are things, we can't rely on regulations to protect us from some of these chemicals because some of them are so toxic and the effect takes so long for us to understand. And we know that our government is not very good at making sure that these things don't happen. So another important thing about looking at the problem with building products is to really understand, is transparency important? And we think it is important. And based on that, the International Living Future Institute came out with a program called DECLARE, where they're encouraging companies to declare what's in their projects. And they're providing labels for companies to do that, to declare everything that's in their products. So it's like an ingredient list for products. And it's an endeavor to increase transparency in the marketplace and apply and provide an opportunity for manufacturers to assure people that there's nothing toxic in their chemicals in it so that they can make a choice on what they want to do. And this project is very similar to what happened in the food industry. Now we have labels on all our food products, processed food products. And initially when this was proposed for the food industry, there was a lot of pushback because they didn't want to describe or didn't want to divulge what was in their products. They had proprietary things that were in there, and there was a lot of resistance. Well, fortunately, that was overcome, and now it's standard to see nutrition labels on products that we eat. But shouldn't we be requiring the same things on the products that would affect us where we live, work, sleep, learn and play? So the DECLARE label answers three simple questions. Where does the product come from? What's it made of? And where does it go at the end of its life? And this program was just launched back in 2015, but we're seeing more and more companies starting to get on the bandwagon and realize that this is an opportunity to differentiate their product in the market. And if they're transparent, there are people who are actually responding to this. And we talked yesterday and today about we need to get industry involved, and we need to get the chemists involved in understanding that there's a market for doing things right. And here's an opportunity through things like the Red List program and through the DECLARE program to show people that there can be things that are better and that there people will buy them and people will demand them. If people will demand them, the supply will go up. So it's really important, I think, for all of us to start recognizing that and devote what our dollars and the products that we use and buy every day. I am happy to say that the International Living Future Institute has opened an office here in Pittsburgh, particularly interested in focusing on working with manufacturers to help them create, to retool existing products to make them be healthier and to help them develop new products that are healthier for people as well. And in September, there'll be the third Living Products Expo here in Pittsburgh, where we'll bring together manufacturers and users of those products to talk about how do we make products healthy for people. So I encourage you to come back for that program. It'll be here in September 11th and 13th at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center. I'd like to close about talking about a different way of looking at the world. And I really like this work that that Carol Sanford talks about. She has this four different ways or four different paradigms of how we interact with the world. The first paradigm is called the extractive model. And in this model, we see the world as all pieces and fragments, and it's all about me. And I'm going to take what I can get, and I don't care who I hurt or what I hurt in the process to get it. I just want to get what's stolen it for me, and I'm going to get what I can. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people in the United States, including some of the people running our country, that think with this model. The second model is called the less bad model. And again, here we still see the world as fragments, but we try to stabilize them. And now we're starting to recognize it's just not about me, but it's about us. And we're starting to see some interconnectedness. But and this is where the environmental movement started, where you know this whole idea of reduce, reuse, recycle, where to try to do less bad. The third model is called a do-good model. Again, it still sees the world as fragments, but now we're trying to improve them. And we recognize that it's not just about me, it's about us, and we start to look at reciprocity. And this is where a lot of the later green building movements have moved towards. We're really trying to do good as opposed to just doing less bad. But none of those are going to get us where we need to go. And the last model, and the model which I think we really need to move towards, is called the regenerative model. And here we don't see fragments. We see the world as a whole. And we're a system nested in lesser systems and larger systems. And we recognize that everything's interconnected. And everything we do affects everything else. And it's truly all about us. We're all in this together, not only us as people, but us as all the other species we share the planet with as well. And this is where we really need to go. And if you think about it, if we all were thinking from a regenerative point of view, we wouldn't be having a meeting like this. Because there's no way, if you were thinking from a regenerative point of view, that you would ever do anything that would hurt somebody else or something else when you in your process of doing it. So this is where, through the rest of the presentations, we're going to talk about short-term solutions, about things we need to do to address some of these acute problems that we have. But the long-term, we all really need to be thinking about a regenerative way of thinking. And it means going in a totally different direction from what we've been doing right now. We have to stop following the flock. We have to break out on our own and truly create a new way of thinking about how we interact with the world. Thank you. Yes, Pete.
Great talk, and thanks for your service on the board of the International Living Future Institute. So,
thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Tyrone and I were in Barcelona speaking on a panel a couple of summers ago, and the guy who spoke between us was from one of these companies that manufactures doubt about the safety of chemicals. It was really interesting. And it speaks to the use of lists. What he said was, you know, we can manipulate the process of risk assessment. We're inside the game. We're sitting at the table with the regulators. We can get the answers we want that make it look like our products are safe, but we can't deal with lists. Lists, you can't manipulate other than what goes on them.
Right.
But companies are increasingly turning to lists and it's moving markets. And I love the way you guys have built upon that opportunity to make a difference today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. I just wanted to say something about labeling. So while we do have food ingredients, we don't have them all. Right. So if you go to a tin can, it will not say as one of the ingredients, BPA. You go to something that's packaged in plastic, it will not say on that ingredient, you know, diethylhexylphthalate. So I think we're part of the way there, but we're certainly not.
You're absolutely right. This is a process that we need to go through. And we're moving in that direction. And full transparency is where we really need to go.
Hi, I'm Alex Goh. I'm actually with the International Living Future Institute in our Pittsburgh office, and so just wanted to give an open invitation to come chat with me afterwards. We're always welcome to feedback about our programs and our lists, and especially as we revise the red list to come out with a new version in the next year or two. As someone who came from a green chemistry undergrad background, that's something that I'm really passionate about. So as we try to improve our programs, I'd really love to hear back feedback from everyone.
Thank you, Alex. I was looking for you before. Thanks.
Thank you. Another group that's very influential politically in this country is the anti-abortion group, which call themselves pro-life. And I prefer them to call themselves Truth in Advertising, that they're anti-abortion. But if they call themselves pro-life, then your foe's first picture of preparing a room for a newborn child should be something that might be a connection to them. So my point is, can we make connections with groups where you probably couldn't talk about overpopulation because they wouldn't want to talk about that? But if you were to, and I think we need to have groups that connect rather than saying, well, this is my only issue, and this is my only issue. And do you know of any group or any way to say, okay, you're pro-life and pro-birth, well, then this is obviously something you should be concerned about.
It's an interesting thought. Yes.
I just wanted to follow up with a quick resource regarding the question. There's an organization called the Sustainability Interfaith Institute, and they do work exactly around these issues. So that might be a point of connection if you don't already have it. I'm happy to introduce you.
Okay, great, thank you.
I'm seeing your face, you might be a little concerned, but I would like to say something that is very important, and that's called passion, leadership, and action. And it's the reaching across the boundaries.
I need to swallow it, okay?
Yeah.
So passion, action, and commitment. And this is something that you have been able to do, and this is something we need many, many times more. And there are opportunities now in Pittsburgh and elsewhere to reach across these kinds of boundaries because it's the systems and the integration. So maybe we should found a new club called Passion, Action, and Commitment, and wonder what you would have to recommend in that to universities. Not that nothing is there, but that the systems integration is still a very large issue.
Yeah. Well, I think if we were going to do something like that, Volker, I think everybody in this room would be there because you all are showing you're passionate and care about this issue because you're all here. And I would encourage you to continue that passion and commitment to start to make some of the changes that we need to see as we go out, as we leave this conference. Thank you.
Yeah, and you're the great example.
Well, thank you.